We were always the poor relatives, even when we came into question as relatives. But most certainly, we were poor. After all, we had been sitting for a good 250 years in the periphery of Central Europe, and were just a stone's throw away from the Balkans and another stone's throw away from the Ottoman Empire and nowadays Turkey. The region was the Romanian Banat, and our we sat in its Banat Swabian villages. However, when we had luck, or were sick, or had important documents to submit or certify somewhere, we traveled to Temeswar, to the Romanian Temeswara, the Hungarian Temeswar, and the Nazi German Temesburg. I was only reminded of this Nazi German Temesburg once again in February 1975 as a fresh immigrant from Romania upon arrival in the late evening at the gate of the refugee camp Unamassen, where I had to introduce myself in order to enter. The somewhat disgruntled porter, whom I quickly identified as a former compatriot through the tingled dialect of his German, asked me where I was from. When I told him that I just came from Gießen, where I had spent the day at study counseling, he shook his head indignantly and said he had asked me about my homeland. My answer that I came from Temeswar threw him into a fluster. He barked at me, "The city is called Temesburg. Note that, young man." In such a scenario, the best thing to do is click your heels together and snap your right arm in the air. Otherwise, Temeswar was a city with streetcars and buses, with girls and young ladies in miniskirts and flared trousers, with the Bega Canal, which meandered through the parks of the city, and with districts called Josefstadt, Elisabethstadt, Fabrikstadt, and Innerestadt. One commemorated Prince Eugene and Count Mercy and fancied the idea of being Little Vienna. Anyhow, a telling number of Temeswar Germans were descendants of highly dubious Austrian clerks and low-ranking military, and spoke a quite dreadful German, the bottom rung of Viennese suburban dialect, which over time became permeated with words of Hungarian, Serbian, and Romanian origin. Like the admired Vienna, the city had a plague column and a cathedral. But naturally, it didn't have an emperor, and thus, a fortiori, no empress. Rather, in the best case, a vicegerent and a governor of the Banat. The region had been populated by German colonists from Baden and Württemberg, Lorraine, Bavaria, and Bohemia, as well as the Palatinate since the 20s of the 18th century. And these early colonists quickly began to secure their existence, build a house on the allocated plot of land, drain the marshy soil, make it arable, and cultivate agriculture needed for survival. They still had to tend to the stables for the animals they brought along, acquire equipment, build streets. So clearly, fighting glorious battles was one of the last things on their mind. Rather, they still had to wrestle with getting the cow and the plow horse through the winter as healthy as possible. What an antique chariot adorned with a lightly clad winged lady should represent was not yet disclosed in the early almanac of the Banat Swabian family friend. Even though it was finally published on a regular basis after many years, the Greek pantheon of the gods and heroes was not one of its burning topics. For where there's no parliament, there's no need for a fountain in front of it. And on the non-existent fountain, no palace Athena can stand. And hence, this with good reason non-existent palace Athena, sure enough, does not hold a Nike in the cusp of her right hand. Between the two women, the one colossal, the other tiny as a puppet, who represent wisdom, power, warfare, and triumph in the distant capital, this gesture seems somewhat tender and ruminant. At any rate, the bigger goddess, if we view her from the side, looks like she just covered her lips with her free left hand, as if it just went through her head how dubious this stiff pose on a public fountain must appear after two world wars. Can time and space have the same measure, be at equal distance? What is the unit of measure for the complete other matter? If what is differentiated is good, as Hölderlin claims, then is sameness bad? Aren't the capital and the province two different states of the world? Is every thought ever thought in the province smaller, more humble, more trivial? Does the Temeshvar Hercules, if he exists, only manage two or three of the 12 labors, while the Viennese Heracles tackles all 12, as the myth goes? Is Prometheus cut out of the entrepreneurial elite in the capital, Epimetheus for the sedate dreamers and lonely thinkers of the province? Anyway, my friend Rodica from Temeshvar reports that there are busts of quite a number of famous Romanians in the local Central Park. For example, those of Prince Eugene of Savoy and Count Florimond de Mercy. Given the importance of these great Romanians for the city of Temeshvar and the entire Hungarian-Serbian-Romanian Banat, one might notice, besides the generous gesture of appropriation, a certain restraint in the honorable commemoration. As part of a group of 8 bronze busts on black marble pedestals, the slightly parodistic portrayal of modern Banat's forefathers was unveiled together with 3 other important Romanians named Béla Bartók, János Török, and Karl Küttl, alongside 3 statues of now also ethnic Romanians on August 3, 2009, to a largely indifferent audience. In its Dodererian cunningness, coupled with an irony of Kraussian finesse and Bernhardian malice, this staging successfully exposed honorable commemoration as a fundamental error of being in the world. The park had learned how to disguise itself from its own history, founded in 1870 by fortress commander Anton von Scudier on the grounds of the former military cemetery. It bore the name Scudier Park until the end of the First World War. At the end of the 1940s, it was renamed into Stalin Park. From the mid-50s until the end of communism, Central Park. And today, Scudier Central Park. But it is certainly no coincidence, however, that Berggasse 19 resident Dr. Freud, who was destined to describe the mental state, the irritations and crises in the psychology of the modern man at the turn of the 19th to 20th century, resorted to Oedipus and Narcissus and other figures from ancient mythology, as he had already surrounded himself with a great number of antique art objects. Apparently, it seemed appropriate, and not just in Berggasse 19, that a renaissance of antiquity could help come to grips with the crises of the modern world, with its acceleration, its fragmentation of all human functions on the assembly lines, with the control of machines and human crowds alike, as well as the terrifying speed of trains and automobiles, that its gods, goddesses, heroes, and muses could offer interpretative schemes for an increasingly complex and, with the inflation of knowledge about its downsides, progressively unreadable world. When the Christian God is steadily losing clout, even declared dead by an irate philosopher from the German lands, there is little point in hiding behind a cross or a statue of the Virgin Mary for solace and security. You straighten up before Pallas Athena, feast on Fama's bare breast, head for the stock exchange or casino with the image of Fortuna in your mind's eye. When art, the illusion, becomes one with reality in this identity system, reality itself attains the quality of the illusion. Then art has everything to do with reality, but reality itself no longer has anything to do with reality. Philosopher Odo Marquardt wrote this in his essay Gesamtkunstwerk und Identitätssystem, The Total Work of Art and the Identity System. After expanding the conventional understanding of the total work of art, the multimedia totalizing of the individual arts into a single artwork, with another dimension with the connection between art and reality. When artistic artifacts, which have or can be assigned a fluid or at least fluctuating meaning, encounter reality and should exemplify, interpret, or reinforce it in its ideals, a highly suspicious, or put more politely, hybrid melange emerges. Greek and Roman heroes, gods, and specters are embodied in supra-dimensional sculptures and propped up on representative places of a community, integrated into buildings, exhibited on roofs between the pedestrian and the heavens to those who might soar to these heights in helicopters in 100 years. Otherwise, they are viewed by contemporary passersby with a kink in the neck as hard to decipher antiques and never truly understood. The antique world, to which the epitomizing stone commands momentous respect, and its shimmering luster attain an echelon of reality. The statues standing around the frescoes on the facades, the caryatides and atlases are part of a reality that they are not going to disappear from soon. And they are far more prevalent in the modern cityscape than Christian symbols, whose significance has suffered as much over time as the knowledge about these antique-like city furnishings. What the gaze of the photographer captured in my mind, of all the figures standing there, floating, repositioned after restoration, appears to be a substantial part of the total work of art, prior to that of Richard Wagner or Marcotte and whatever the other names of Hollywood forerunners are. Even more so, ever since I envisioned this frenzy of artistic representation through the photos of Christine de Goncy, I know that this architectonic, city-furnishing, decorative and metaphysically inflating enterprise should be deemed the truly convincing total work of art. Naturally, in connection with the city that surrounds these bronze casts and sculptured stone blocks, its noises, its demanding advertising, the daily life paths of its inhabitants who are completely impervious to these mighty figures, and let's not forget, the cluelessness of those who get a glimpse of one of these Nikes or Famas or Fortunas or Pallas Athenas every now and then. We see only that which looks back at us, disclosed Berlin flaneur Franz Hessel at the beginning of the 20th century. He knew Berlin inside out like his pants pocket, Paris like his vest pocket. After all, he let the houses and palaces of Berlin and Paris take a long, hard look at him. The lady with the camera must have also taken a close look at Empress Maria Theresia on her high throne in a tête-à-tête with the unclothed sun god Helios on the cupola of the Natural History Museum. Otherwise, she wouldn't have been perceived in all her crownless nakedness now, thanks to Christine de Grancy, by me as well.